Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Russian warplanes over Europe, warships near Australia. What do these and other demonstrations of power mean in the current politics between Russia and the West? But first, one of the country's preeminent law scholars makes his case against the Supreme Court. We are joined by Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the University of California at Irvine Law School and a distinguished constitutional scholar. Chemerinsky's latest book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Erwin Chemerinsky. It is great to have you back here with us.
It's great to talk with you once again.
I am surprised and delighted about your new book and about your disillusionment. What happened?
I realized that though I've been teaching constitutional law for 35 years, I've been making excuses for the Supreme Court. When I cover cases like Dred Scott versus Stanford, Plessy versus Ferguson, Korematsu versus United States, I've been teaching them as if they're aberrations. And I realized that all too often through American history, the Supreme Court has failed, often in the most important times, in the most important ways. I've been very critical of the Supreme Court over all of this time. It occurred to me, somebody need to write the book that says, you know, the Supreme Court has too often failed. We need to take steps to make the Supreme Court better.
You open with this case about a victim of eugenics, Carrie Buck. Who was she and why did you make her case the important one to make the case against the Supreme Court?
It's a case that people who went to law school have heard of, but usually it's just a footnote in constitutional law casebooks. But I've been surprised in speaking to audiences, almost no non-lawyers have ever heard of this case. Carrie Buck was born in 1906 in Charlottesville, Virginia. She went through the sixth grade at the local public schools. She was always at grade level. By all accounts, she was a normal child. Her father left her mother. Her mother was destitute. They had no choice but to put Carrie and her siblings in foster homes. Carrie remained with her foster family, doing house chores and other work around the house. When Carrie was 17, she was raped by her foster father's nephew. Carrie became pregnant as a result of the rape. Her foster parents were humiliated by Carrie's pregnancy. They had Carrie institutionalized and was called a home for epileptics and the feeble-minded. Carrie gave birth to a daughter there. Virginia then began a proceeding to have a tubal ligation performed on Carrie to have her involuntarily sterilized without her consent. An IQ test was given to Carrie. It was a primitive form of the test, and somebody testified that she had a low IQ. Many years later, Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould found Carrie and gave her a modern IQ test, and Carrie had an IQ in the normal range. A social worker testified that she looked at Carrie's baby, who was then 6 months old, and the social worker said, quote, something doesn't seem right about the baby. It was ordered that Carrie be surgically sterilized. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. This should have been an easy case for the Supreme Court. This was cruel and unusual punishment that the Constitution prohibits. Carrie, after all, did nothing wrong. The Supreme Court has long said that the word liberty in the Constitution protects fundamental aspects of family autonomy, including the right to procreate. But the Supreme Court, 8-1, ruled against Carrie Buck. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the most revered of all Supreme Court justices, declared some of the most insensitive language, some of the most offensive language found in the United States reports, quote, three generations of imbeciles is enough. It's a horrific decision. 60,000 United States citizens were involuntarily surgically sterilized as a result of this decision in the eugenics movement. 60,000 people were denied their fundamental right to choose whether to have a child.
These are failures of societies as well as failures of the court, because the courts sometimes just conform to the norms of society. You say they are siding with the powerful. I agree. But it's a cultural element. Do you think that's part of it, or do you think it's just their sense of privilege and ideology?
Certainly, it's part of it. There was a eugenics movement in society. Many of the tragic Supreme Court decisions were the court going along. In Korematsu, the Supreme Court upholding the evacuation and internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans. That was the court going along. But I believe that the court exists to stop society when society is compromising our most fundamental values. There are also instances where society is trying to act more progressively, and it's the court that prevents that. When Congress adopted the first law that prohibited the use of child labor, it was the Supreme Court that declared it unconstitutional. Countless children were maimed or even killed because of that. Or to take a more recent example, a year ago, June, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is the first time since the 19th century that the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a federal civil rights law dealing with race. There, society was doing something better, and the Supreme Court prevented it.
When we look at the course of history, even the founding documents of the Constitution itself, the founding fathers were not exactly the most democratic people. The original Constitution protected the slave owners and the slave trade. Where did this idea come from that the court should uphold the minority rights?
It's clear that the Constitution was in part about protecting minority rights. The framers would have thought of minorities as political minorities, as religious minorities. Today we would speak of racial and ethnic minorities, sexual orientation minorities. That's not what the framers were concerned about. But the framers knew that the majority rarely needs a constitution or the courts. The majority can do what it wants through the democratic process. It's minorities who need this protection. The framers were also aware from world history that in times of crisis, there's a tendency to centralize power, and there's a tendency to have our short-term passions cause us to lose sight of our long-term values.
And yet, they protected the slave owners.
There's no doubt that the Constitution protected the institution of slavery and slave owners. The South simply would not have accepted a Constitution that abolished slavery. I always ask my students, my college students, my law students, if they were Northerners who believed that slavery was morally abhorrent, would they have accepted the Constitution that protected it? Would they have been better off saying the North will have its own country and the South will have its country, but not to agree to a compromise that so clearly protected the institution of slavery?
Other areas of law that we've also seen, like the death penalty, the court has ruled very discriminatory.
Yes, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to deal with the problem of race discrimination by government. The Supreme Court has said that the only way of challenging race discrimination under the Constitution is by proving that the government intentionally discriminated based on race. Just showing that this racially discriminatory impact isn't enough. To make that less abstract, I'll use your example, the death penalty. Statistics show, and they showed all over the country, that the death penalty is far more likely to be imposed for African-American or Latino offenders than for white offenders. The death penalty is much more likely to be imposed if it's a black killing a white person than if it's a white person killing a black or a Latino. If this came to the Supreme Court in 1987, and the Supreme Court 5-4 said, it doesn't matter what the statistics show, proof of racially discriminatory impact of the death penalty does not demonstrate a denial of equal protection. There would have to be proof that the legislature adopted the death penalty with the purpose of discriminating, or that this jury acted out of a discriminatory motive. And those are impossible hurdles to meet.
The court has also not always been great on the First Amendment, on issues of free press and free speech. People have been jailed for speaking out. There have been highlights where we've seen the court protect speech.
One general point I try to make in the book is that in times of crisis, the Supreme Court has not enforced the Constitution. I point to World War I cases that you mentioned. During World War I, Congress passed two statutes, one in 1917 and one in 1918, that made it a crime to criticize the draft and the war effort. You mentioned the case of Schenck. He circulated a leaflet in which he argued that the military draft was involuntary servitude in violation of the 13th Amendment. There wasn't the slightest indication that Schenck's leaflet had the slightest adverse effect on military recruitment or the war effort. Nonetheless, Schenck was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The Supreme Court upheld his conviction and his sentence, in an opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. You mentioned Eugene Debs. He was a socialist leader. He gave a speech to an audience saying, quote, "You are good for more than cannon fodder. There's more that I'd like to say, but I can't." For that speech, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. The Supreme Court upheld his conviction in his sentence. And this is a pattern through history where the court has not enforced the Constitution in times of crisis.
So it seems your argument is that the Warren Court is really the anomaly.
There's much to applaud about the Warren Court. Earl Warren became Chief Justice in 1954. He remained Chief Justice till 1969. It was the Warren Court that ended segregation, declaring that separate can never be equal. It was the Warren Court that expanded rights, like voting and privacy rights. It was the Warren Court that significantly increased the protections for criminal defendants under the Constitution. And yet, we have to realize that the Warren Court didn't do nearly as much as it should have and could have. Pick two examples where we all applaud the Warren Court. One is Brown versus Board of Education, which said that separate but equal has no place with regard to American public education. Yet look at American public schools today, how they're increasingly separate and unequal. I think the Supreme Court deserves a great deal of the blame for that. Or my other example is Gideon versus Wainwright. It was this landmark case that held that anyone facing a possible prison sentence has a right to an attorney in state court. Isn't it amazing that until 1963, a state could convict a person, even put the person in prison for life without an attorney? And yet today in the country, so many people are being tried for crimes, even capital crimes, with woefully inadequate lawyers.
And it seems to me that this is a pattern. There was an intentional effort to rein in the court. And since then, we've seen a lot of these things move increasingly back towards the corporate power, big government power against the individual. Now, let's fast forward to the more current courts. You specifically singled out the Bush versus Gore case. We know the result. What are the constitutional implications of that? And why did you single that one out?
To start with, I want to agree with what you said, that I think that this is very much a result of politicians in elections. Richard Nixon ran against the Warren Court when he ran for president in 1968. And when he was elected, he appointed four justices between 1969 and 1971, who dramatically changed the course of constitutional law. Ronald Reagan appointed very conservative justices like Antonin Scalia. George H.W. Bush put Clarence Thomas on the court. George W. Bush put John Roberts and Samuel Alito. They've given us the very conservative court that we have today. The reason I focus on Bush versus Gore is that I think it is one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history. The Supreme Court invented a constitutional rule that's never been cited by the Supreme Court since, and the Supreme Court decided a matter that's clearly for the Florida courts, a question of Florida law, and made George W. Bush president. How different history would have been over the last 13 years if George W. Bush hadn't been president of the United States.
Like you've said, this is not necessarily a place it should insert itself, this political question.
Well, I think, if nothing else, the court got involved way too soon. What the Supreme Court said was that it's a denial of equal protection to treat similar ballots differently in the counting. But there was no indication yet that similar ballots were being treated differently. The Florida Supreme Court on Friday, December 8th, 2000, sent the matter to a Superior Court judge, a trial court judge in Florida, Terry Lewis, and said, oversee the counting. And Lewis said, if there's any dispute, I'll resolve it. That seems to indicate that similar ballots would be treated the same. But the Supreme Court on Saturday, December 9th, ended the counting, and then on December 12th, the Supreme Court in Bush versus Gore decided the election by saying all counting in Florida had to stop. That meant that Bush would get the Florida electors, Al Gore conceded the next morning, Wednesday, December 13th. Bush v. Gore was the first time that the Supreme Court decided a presidential election.
You're critical of some of the justices for stating in their confirmations that they were acting more like umpires in a game, where really what they're doing is deciding the terms of the game, like what the game itself is, essentially what the ballpark is going to be. And that affects how laws are made, what kinds of laws are made, and who gets to participate and in what way.
John Roberts, at his confirmation hearings in the summer of 2005, said, Supreme Court justices are just like umpires calling balls and strikes. Sonia Sotomayor, at her confirmation hearings in 2009, said, judges just apply the law, they don't make the law. John Roberts and Sonia Sotomayor should be ashamed of themselves for giving such a misleading sense of the judicial process to the American people. Supreme Court justices have tremendous discretion. How they exercise that discretion is a product of their views, their values, their life experience. What's an unreasonable search and seizure? Does the state have a compelling interest in saying that minors under 18 can't have access to violent video games? Does the state have a compelling interest in having diversity in the classroom and having affirmative action? All of these are value choices. Umpires aren't making value choices, and whatever the Supreme Court does makes the law.
When we look at them into the bigger picture, Citizens United is one that you also called out, I think rightly so. It essentially lays out the playing field, who can play, who can't play, who can have a voice. At the same time, limiting the power of unions while boosting the power of corporations in the decisions that they make also shapes the politics of the future.
Absolutely. In Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court held that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money from their corporate treasuries to get candidates elected or candidates defeated. This is having a devastating effect on our political system. We'll never know how many candidates chose not to run for office because of the corporate wealth that was going to be arrayed against them. We'll never know how many elections were decided, especially in small towns or in smaller states, just by corporate spending. Ironically, perversely, at the same time, in other cases like Knox versus SEIU, in a more recent case in June of this year, Harris versus Quinn, the Supreme Court has very much limited the political power of unions. This court, the John Roberts Court, is systematically strengthening the political influence of corporations and weakening the political influence of unions. It's not coincidental.
It is also not upholding voting rights. So it seems like the entire ball game is being changed.
I think the ball game is being changed. I already mentioned with regard to voting rights, in June 2013, in Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. But I'll give an even more recent example, one that occurred after my book was published in September. On Saturday morning, October 18th, the Supreme Court allowed a Texas law to go into effect, even though a federal district court found it would keep 600,000 people from voting, almost all African Americans and Latinos. A federal district court judge held a 9-day trial and wrote a 143-page opinion about how the law had the purpose and the effect of discriminating against minority voters. Three federal judges had come to the same conclusion before the Voting Rights Act was struck down. The Supreme Court, 6-3, without a word of explanation, said the Texas law could go into effect for the November 4th election. At the very least, the Supreme Court should have explained to the American people why this judge's 143-page opinion was wrong.
You have some ideas for how to reform the Supreme Court. You think we need better ethics, more transparency, a different confirmation system. How do we approach this?
In the next to the last chapter of the book, I suggest many ways of reforming the court. Let's start by clearly defining the role of the court. Let's, as a society, say, and let's have the court say, that above all, the court exists to enforce the Constitution, to protect minorities, especially in times of crisis. I think we should go to a merit selection system for Supreme Court justices. I think we should have a much more meaningful confirmation process. I remember Senator Joe Biden saying to me at the time of the Samuel Alito hearings that it was all just an exercise in kabuki theater. We should have, I think, term limits for Supreme Court justices, 18-year non-renewable terms. Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1991 when he was 43 years old. If he remains until he is 90, the age at which Justice Stevens retired, Clarence Thomas will be a justice for 47 years. It's too much power held by a single individual for too long a period of time. We should change the way the court communicates with the American people. I believe there should be cameras in every Supreme Court proceeding so the American people can see its government at work. The ethical rules that apply to federal district court and court of appeals judges must be applied to Supreme Court justices. No longer should be left to each justice to decide for himself or herself whether to be recused in a case.
Two areas that you didn't talk about is the number of justices. I've thought 9 justices was too few, given the population of the U.S. Do you think 9 is still okay?
I don't know how to determine what's the magic right number of Supreme Court justices. We got to 9 by a historical accident. When the Constitution was written, there's no specification in it of the number of justices. The first Judiciary Act in 1789 created 5 justices. Then, as the country expanded time, there was a new area. They appointed a new Supreme Court justice. So it got to 10 justices in the 1860s. Hard for us to imagine 10 justices and the possibility of ties. Andrew Johnson was a terribly unpopular president. He was from Tennessee, and he became president when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. To keep Andrew Johnson from filling a vacancy, the Supreme Court was reduced from 10 to 9 justices, and it's been 9 ever since. Would 11 be better? Would 13 be better? Would 15 be better? As the court gets larger, there's certainly more inefficiency in terms of getting its work done. I also worry that when there's a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, if they increase the numbers, then when there's a Republican president, Republican Senate, they'll increase the numbers, and there's no stopping point. So I shrug as 9. Nothing magical about it, but I don't know that 11, 13, 15, or 25 would be better.
To enforce the Constitution being the primary purpose of the Supreme Court, and yet it gave itself this power of judicial review to strike down laws early in its first court. It's not explicitly stated in the Constitution, and yet we've accepted it. Why do you continue to support judicial review itself, given it's not in the Constitution?
I've spent almost 40 years now representing individuals who realistically have no chance of success in the political process. I've represented inmates on death row who are facing death sentences. I've represented people who have been sentenced to life in prison for minor crimes like shoplifting. I've represented a Guantanamo detainee. I've represented a homeless man before the United States Supreme Court. I know for my clients, it's the courts or nothing. They may lose in the courts, but they're not going to win in the legislature. When's the last time any state legislature adopted a law to increase rights for criminal defendants? When's the last time a state legislature adopted a law to give more rights to prisoners? I think if the Constitution is going to be enforced, we need the courts. This is what Marbury versus Madison said in 1803. The limits of the Constitution have meaning only if they're enforced. We need the courts to be there to enforce the Constitution.
Erwin Chemerinsky, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to talk with you.
Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the University of California at Irvine Law School. His latest book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. When we come back, Power Politics with Russia and the West. Stay tuned. How can I save my little boy from Oppenheimer's deadly toy? There is no monopoly of common sense on either side of the political fence. We share the same biology, regardless of ideology. Believe me when I say, love their children. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, we began discussing the deteriorating relations between Russia, Ukraine, and the West. As antagonisms increase, we continue to analyze the situation. With us are two experts in the region. Henry Hale is a professor of political science and international affairs and co-director of the program on new approaches to research and security in Eurasia at George Washington University. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? The Foundations of Ethnic Politics. Henry Hale's latest book is Patronal Politics, Eurasian Regime Dynamics and Comparative Perspective. Martha Merritt is the Associate Dean for International Education at the University of Chicago. She's the author of A Geopolitics of Identity, Drawing the Line Between Russia and Estonia. And she's contributing author of Russian and Soviet History from the Time of Troubles to the Collapse of the Soviet Union. Welcome to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. Henry Hale, I'd like to begin with you. You've been critical of how many have been framing this situation with Russia as a new Cold War. You've said this is inappropriate, and yet many media outlets seem to be using this almost like an echo chamber. How would you characterize the situation that we're finding ourselves in?
Well, I think the Cold War frame is useful to many journalists because it's something that you can easily point to and it resonates because it's been one of the main ways that Russia has been thought about in popular media and just popular consciousness over the years. But I think there are just a lot of differences between the current situation and what we faced in the Cold War. For one thing, it's not driven, I think, by ideology. I don't see Putin, for example, as representing a kind of ideology that has global ambitions, among other things. The conflict itself is much more limited in scope. It's not a competition where the United States and something like the Soviet Union are competing over influence in Africa or Latin America, those kinds of things. And I guess I just see the crisis as having much more contingent roots rather than being rooted in very deep differences of the kind that I mentioned earlier. I think a lot of it has to do with domestic conditions in Russia that are contingent and could have been avoided, but that also might not be nearly as lasting as the factors that were driving the Cold War.
Martha Merritt, would you agree?
I agree that this is not another Cold War. In fact, it's a very contemporary manifestation of an even old-fashioned form of conflict, and that is this is a highly local iteration of tension. And what we're finding in the modern age is it's very difficult for large powers like the United States to deal with highly localized conflicts.
Last week when we had a panel on this, and John Mearsheimer has been explaining the conflict through the eyes of NATO expansion being a threat to Russia. Do you think that's a big role, Henry Hale?
I think at a certain level, fear of and antipathy to NATO is in play. Russian citizenry, as well as the elites, have had a negative perception of NATO expansion, even dating back to the 1990s. And their basic attitude is, well, why does this organization exist if it was meant to counter the Soviet Union? And so the fact that it's continuing has been interpreted by many in Russia as some indication of something other than goodwill towards Russia, something that complicates trust. But I don't think it's fair to say that the expansion of NATO caused this particular crisis. I think most Russians don't really see this as a threat. It's something they feel uncomfortable with. But as I said, I think that the real roots of the crisis now are much more in a particular situation in Russian politics that makes this particular issue salient. And so it's the kind of situation where I think in particular the Putin administration needs some kind of issue that helps consolidate the citizenry around it. And NATO happens to be one such issue that can be mobilized for that way. And so it stokes the issue rather than it being just something that has naturally caused this kind of reaction in Russia and that Putin is just simply reflecting the sentiment in Russia.
Martha Merritt, you've also, in some of your work, said something along these lines. Is this how you see it as well?
Well, I'm probably a little more inclined to look at the historical sense of Russians feeling encircled by threat. John Mearsheimer often cites, and I think rightly, the fact that Russia has been invaded in ways that were deep and meaningful to them. Capital Moscow, captured by Napoleon a long time ago, still plays a war in popular imagination. And of course, the Germans being virtually within a stone throw of Moscow itself also is not ancient history for them. So this sense of being circled by threat is one that Putin plays up. I agree with Henry Hale that, you know, in some senses, NATO expansionism is being used by the current administration. But the fact that this resonates with the population and does tap popularly held fears, I think, is salient. I lived in Estonia for a year, 93, 94, when that state was really setting itself up. And all those complex tensions with large numbers of Russians in Estonia and Latvia, Moscow not being particularly sympathetic to the actual plight of those Russians and that they weren't necessarily welcome back to Russia. But they represent a very real playing card in the international card game that all of this has become, because Russia saying that it must defend its people in the abstract is a kind of vital political issue in people's imaginations in Russia, even if actual physical beings are not being actively taken into account by those who rule from the Kremlin.
That actually brings back something that Henry Hale has written about. You've talked about this sort of different strands of nationalism related to Russia and Russians. How do you see this?
In thinking about nationalism, I think it is important to recognize that there are different forms of nationalism. On one hand, you can have a nationalism that is ethnically exclusive, that's about, say, ethnic Russian purity of the Russian state. And on the other hand, you can have a nationalism that is more, for lack of a better word, imperial, that's inclusive in the sense of recognizing many different groups as belonging to the larger Russian nation. But therefore is also expansionist in wanting to restore Russia's territorial control, say, over former parts of the Soviet Union, maybe reintegrating the former Soviet Union entirely in some form or other. And I think one of the key differences is that your ethnically exclusive Russian nationalism might even be willing to tolerate a shrinking of Russia as long as it made it more ethnically pure. There's some survey indicating that over 10% of the population would be happy to get rid of the Islamic areas of the North Caucasus part of Russia, for example. And I think that has to do with antipathy towards those people, sort of a xenophobia. On the other hand, the imperial Russian nationalist not only would want to be sure to keep that, but they would be happy to bring in very different peoples of the former USSR, including your Tajiks and your Uzbeks, groups that are traditionally Muslim, but have shared a certain history in the Russian Empire and in the Soviet Union together with Russia, and therefore seen by these nationalists as having a lot in common, belonging to what they would call the Russian world.
Both of you have written about the internal-external dynamics and the institutions within Russia. And Henry Hale, you wrote about how the Putin government was worried for its political survival because it had started to lose popular support in 2011 or so. Is this what you were talking about when you said that the domestic forces are an important aspect of the crisis today?
Yes, public support is something that has been underestimated as far as something that helps keep the current system in Russia together. I mean, one reason that the regime there has managed to stay in power and avoided having more major crises, I think, is because large numbers of the, large shares of the Russian people have supported it. Among other things, for example, if a leader has, like Putin, has a great deal of actual public support, it becomes much harder for Democrats to win allies by calling for democracy, because if you support democracy, then, well, maybe Putin will win anyway. And so if you have crucial supporters of Putin, people who provide the muscle behind Putin staying in power, they're less likely to break with him if they think that, well, even a free and fair election would return Putin himself. And so I think one of the phenomena that we saw, starting with the financial crisis that really hit Russia very hard, leading to negative economic growth in 2009, was a gradual decline in public support for Putin and his party, United Russia. And ultimately, the result of this, through a bunch of other complicated events, was a massive protest movement that erupted in 2011 and 2012, which I think had the regime very, very worried. So in that context, it started searching for new bases of public support. And when you had this revolution that took place in Ukraine earlier this year, with pro-European protesters overthrowing the leadership that Putin himself had backed, that not only threatened to make Putin look weak and threatened to cost Russia its control over vital assets like the Black Sea Fleet potentially. But it also had the potential to revive this protest movement. And so I think this helps explain why Putin has turned much more forcefully to a general form of nationalism than he had done in the past. Nationalism in many cases can be divisive, but I think now he decided it was worth taking the risk.
Martha Merritt, you've said that war is used as state building in Russia. Is that the case here?
It's significant we mention that this is Ukraine specifically, as opposed to, say, skirmishing over Georgia, which is in the not too distant past, but was not nearly as emotive and, of course, didn't yield quite as concrete a land grab. You know, Ukraine is the heart of Russian-ness. It's the founding of Rus, the base of the empire that the imperial leadership built. So Ukraine has a very tight emotional meaning for Russians, in the sense that when the Crimea was absorbed by Russia, it's commonly perceived as reabsorbed, not a new acquisition. It's sort of like there was this natural state of being in the minds of some leading political actors, and I think the public, and it was broken when the Soviet Union broke up. Even Yeltsin, in brokering that breakup of the Soviet Union with other leaders, I think that he felt Ukraine going off on its own was the least desirable of all these independence movements, but it's the deal that worked so that Yeltsin could unseat Gorbachev. We can recall that Putin, in this book called, Henry, you probably remember this, First Person, this book that was put out when he was first campaigning for president. One of the few things in it that really rang true to me was he said that the worst day of his life was when he was in Germany waiting for instructions from Moscow as the wall was falling, and nothing came. He got no message from the kind of mastership about what to do. In other words, Moscow had failed. And so this breakup of the Soviet Union, I think both in his mind and in the minds of many people who have a security sort of background, was this colossal loss for Russia that will take many, many years to recover from. And this is the backdrop against which recent events have given Putin and people who think like him a chance to kind of resurrect Russian greatness. I think it's not random. I agree that the timing is particularly fortuitous for Putin to rally forces in support of him. Economic wealth not being at its all-time high in Russia right now, the sort of stirrings of patriotism are important. But I think it's not just chance that it's Ukraine. I think Ukraine is very close to being perceived as a vital interest for Russia and intimately linked to Russia both historically and now.
Would it be different if it were a different leader? Would we be seeing a reaction that looked nothing of the sort, Martha Merritt?
I think it's significant that Putin's security background, of course a former member of the KGB, I think it's significant that he's likely to feel particular threat. And I don't just mean from the movements in Ukraine. I mean also, you know, be keen to perceive threat to Russia itself under certain circumstances. But I also don't think it's by chance that we have somebody who represents the security services in charge of Russia. I think there's a sense among the populace that they want a strong leader. Strength in Russia is probably most easily broadcast by the military and the secret services. And so if it weren't Putin, it's hard for me to imagine somebody else consolidating leadership who didn't have a security services sort of background. So my view is this is not about Putin's personality per se. It's about the kind of strong leadership profile that is most likely to unite Russia at this point in its history.
Henry Hale, do you agree?
Generally, yes. The one nuance that I might add would just be that I think you could have, in theory, a leader with a different type of nationalist view. So I definitely agree with Martha about Putin's outlook and how it was formed. And I think his experience and looking at the loss of Russia's empire, if you will, as a great tragedy, underscores that he belongs more to this imperial nationalist category. He's someone who is more tolerant of different ethnic minorities in the sense of he generally, I think, resists the efforts to persecute individual groups and is more wanting to break down barriers between these countries rather than erect them. But there are other leaders that have some prominent appeal in Russia who I think might have done something different. Dmitry Rogozin, for example, who has flirted much more openly with the more narrow ethnic purist Russian nationalism, might have done some other things. I mean, Crimea is interesting because, you know, Crimea satisfies both type of nationalists, because it's primarily populated by ethnic Russians, and it's also expanding territory towards what had been traditionally assumed to be Russian territory and Soviet territory more generally. But once you start moving to the possibilities of what might happen next, then it starts to get much more complicated. And I would fear that somebody like Rogozin might be much more eager to start to use, for example, the opportunity that Crimea poses exactly to take back some of the territories in whether it's Estonia or Kazakhstan. Again, we can't rule out that maybe Putin will end up doing something like that. But I do think that we might have seen leaders in power that might have done something different. But the counterfactuals are always, you know, hard to nail down, but interesting to think about.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the increasing antagonisms between Russia, Ukraine, and the West. Now, you've also been critical of the portrayals in the media that were used to characterize Mr. Putin.
Yes, there's a tendency to equate him with just simply a czar or, you know, something like that. Whereas I think, on one hand, I mean, he's clearly a leader who doesn't have any problem cracking down on democracy, for example. But at the same time, I think what he represents, and I think this goes along with what Martha said, is a larger system and a kind of power relationship that exists in Russia, where you have a person in charge who's not simply a dictator, but actually manages a very complicated system of these various networks and manages all kinds of relationships, some corrupt, some less corrupt, that are, in fact, very difficult to hold together. I do think that that's one reason why the regime feels threatened by a lot of the events that happened in Ukraine and actually fears the potential for nationalist sentiments that might get out of control. And so I think, you know, he has to respond in some ways to these public sentiments at the same time that he's trying to create them and move them in his own direction. And I think kind of the upshot of all this is that Crimea satisfied a particular situation that he was in, a crisis that he feared could arise if he lost Ukraine completely. And so taking Crimea is kind of overturning the chessboard and creating a new situation, satisfying nationalists of both stripes. But down the road, he starts to face a very, very difficult problem, because if he just stops at Crimea, you're going to have the more imperial Russian nationalists be dissatisfied with him losing a historic chance to restore more of the borders of the former USSR. Whereas if he goes further, he's going to start trying to incorporate populations that are actively hostile and possibly alienate the ethnic purists in Russia, who would fear that these moves would actually make life more difficult within Russia and start bringing in unwanted populations.
I read in the headlines that there are warships going to Australia, that there are warplanes going over the Balkans, that NATO has intercepted these planes. It seems like it's extremely antagonistic toward the West. But why Australia? Can either of you make sense of that? Martha Merritt, what do you think?
I would get the Australia shot.
No.
You know, it's highly relevant, even to this part of the world. You know, this is all saber-rattling in my view. I'll be interested also to hear what Henry has to say about it. These are manifestations of power, and of course, they're both frightening because they look like they don't easily stitch together, but they're much less frightening than having Soviet warplanes trying to buzz Paris or something. You know, there are much more hostile things they could do. So there are modes of saying we're serious without there being an immediate target in the area that's being harassed. And so it's a game, and it's a game with pretty high stakes, because you do end up having things like the airliner that was shot down over Ukraine. You do end up having casualties of something that was meant to be a symbol of power, and you can't always control what happens once you unleash those forces. So it's not cost-free, but it's a form of belligerence short of actually firing a shot. I would say one thing to look out for is Putin already has established a reputation of saying, oh, everybody, let us all be reasonable and seek common ground. And the West tends to kind of take that at face value and assume that means that Russia is stepping down. But we've had a few cases in the last few months where him saying that is the prelude to greater involvement and activism. So given this backdrop of what's going on, and there are many more interceptions, you know, the northern states in Europe have agreed to kind of throw a tighter net so that Russian planes aren't doing these flyovers that are provocative, that are perceived as provocative. So things are kind of ratcheting up. If Putin makes a statement tomorrow saying, don't worry, it's really all nothing, I'm going to be watching the news very carefully.
Henry Hale?
Well, I think that the immediate trigger for the crisis that we see now was the contingent developments that resulted from the revolution in Ukraine and then the response being to seize Crimea. I think that what has happened since then, largely, including in international relations, is that Putin recognizes that it's very difficult to get out of this situation, right, because he faces the potential for international isolation, becoming some kind of a pariah state, not being able to establish the economic relationships that earlier he had pursued very vigorously as a way of reviving Russia's economy. And so I think what he's looking for is a kind of end game, like how can we get out of this situation and kind of save face without just having to just stop and leave things in this stalemate. And I think that one of the ideas that he and many of the thinkers around him have kind of coalesced around is this idea of reshaping the world order. Basically, the idea is that Russia has rejected the kind of world order that they characterize as U.S.-dominated, unipolar, as opposed to multipolar. The current institutions, the criteria, for example, of democracy for membership in important international organizations, all of these reflect sort of what they portray as this America-dominated or maybe Europe-dominated, so Western-dominated international system. And so my guess is that a lot of these challenges around the world, submarine sneaking around Sweden, in its territorial waters apparently, these flybys and the Australian incident, are part of an effort to press the West into renegotiating the world order in a way that it thinks will be beneficial to it. And I think that helps explain, too, why it's seeking China as an ally. China, I think, has similar interests in trying to reduce Western influence. As for why Australia, I have no idea, other than, as I recall, the Australian Prime Minister had threatened to body slam Putin or something like that as a show of force. So maybe this is sort of a sly response on the part of Putin. But other than that, your guess is as good as mine.
The other aspect of Russian international politics that I've noticed, because I study the intersection of media and politics, is that he is expanding as much as he can RT and other forms of media, public diplomacy aspect of it, soft power. Any sense about what this is? Obviously, it's not quite as alarming, but there was a deal made, I believe it was in Argentina, to air RT in Spanish, and then there's been quite a bit of ratcheting up since then. Martha Merritt?
I'm going back to this projection of power theme. This is all about not the military manifestation of power, though that creates a buzz. It's about seizing a high point of command and control on communications and forcing the world press to pay attention in ways that are less damaging than a further invasion of Ukraine. So, Latin America has long been an area where Russia has wanted to manifest power, and there have been times historically when the presence there was higher than now, certainly the political influence. And so this is kind of a we will not be forgotten. We are present. We are here. In addition to these very broad external manifestations of power, one of the things Putin has worked on consistently throughout his time, we've already mentioned that he was more open to the West and more open to ideas about economic integration early in his term, and I think in some ways felt rebuffed in several of those. But a consistent theme has been what I would call the reintegration of Russian and Soviet history. So that's both Imperial Russian history and Soviet history throughout. All of these leaders have been reanimated. There's no leader who isn't talked about now in some way. The West reacted very strongly to Stalin being brought back up after all those decades of silence. But, part of what this represents is Putin is not allowing there to be long blank periods when Russia wasn't Russia. It now must be this kind of long and shining past that leads up to the current day. And so I think he's busy constructing an image in ways that are politically and militarily possible right now of Russia as being a highly relevant power, much as she has been for two centuries, and wants the world to know that there's no part of the globe where Russia is irrelevant.
Henry Hale?
I agree completely with that. And I would just add that I think what these media projects do in part is also just to put out there an alternative narrative, not only about Russia itself and its role in the world, but also just about world events, criticizing interpretations that are prominent in Western discourse, or certainly narratives that are promoted by American government or European governments, and just providing a different set of interpretations out there that people who are inclined to be critical or suspicious of the governments of the West can use. And maybe they reject some of it, but maybe they'll pick up on other parts of it, and maybe it at least casts some doubt on the dominant Western narratives. And so even if very few people actually watch these programs, there are going to be some that watch them and some that turn to them, and they can be fairly effective. I think Russia Today, for example, the English-speaking news service that Russia launched a few years ago, has been more successful than a lot of people thought it would be, and I think partly because it is trying to give voice to these alternative narratives, talking about people like Snowden or Julian Assange, these sorts of things, even when they don't directly have to do with events involving Russia.
If I can add on that RT theme, I think that Radio Free Europe made a profound impression on the current Russian leadership in the sense that they thought it was actually a pretty effective quote-unquote propaganda tool by the West. And so keeping these counter-narratives to the fore, especially at a time when Russia is behaving in a way perceived as belligerent by the West, is a lesson both from previous Western efforts to reach behind the wall in that instance. But it's also, Putin has spent a lot of time with Western leaders he admires, one of whom is Berlusconi in Italy. And Berlusconi is a master of communications and media, one might say disinformation, that served his interests well. And I really think that Putin has paid a lot of attention to how Western governments do this and operates in an environment where he has an even freer hand.
Given where we are with all of this, and it seems like it's escalating, and given the criticism that, say, John Mearsheimer has made of the U.S. responses, what should be a response from, say, the Barack Obama administration at this point? Henry Hale, what do you think?
I wouldn't want to be in the position of the Obama administration. I can definitely tell you that. I think on one level, there's not a whole lot that we can do in the short run, short of actually sending in troops to Ukraine, for example, to get Russia out. But I don't think anybody's talking about that, given Russia does have nuclear weapons, and it probably has a lot more resolve on the ground there to take care of those sorts of challenges than, say, NATO countries would, especially including the differences of points of view within NATO. Similarly, the administration has imposed a number of economic sanctions on Russia, and I think those will have an impact on the Russian economy and on a number of people who are powerful in Russia and close to Putin himself and in his inner circle. But I still don't expect them to be changing Russian policy anytime soon as a result of that. I think when they undertook this policy, Putin and his entourage understood that there would be consequences. So my sense is that these policies that have been enacted are more just to kind of set a price to say, okay, there's a price to pay for annexing the territory of a neighbor state, and this is what it will be. And if it doesn't reverse Russian policy in the shorter term, maybe it will weigh a little bit against their taking further actions. And then possibly several years down the line, my guess is that the public support that's surrounding Putin, this sort of nationalist surge of support, rally around the flag effect, is going to fade. Economic crises are likely to come back unless there's some miracle cure for the Russian economy. And that's when the impact is going to be felt. But even then, I'm not sure that it translates into them just, say, giving back Crimea to Ukraine. So I'm not sure there's a whole lot we can do other than my main recommendation would just be to beef up Ukraine, to help it succeed in its current boundaries at least and become a success story. My guess is that that's one of the greater lessons from the Cold War. Don't like that analogy, but there's one analogy that I think is useful, which is if Ukraine becomes a success story economically and democratically, my guess is that 10, 15 years from now, the situation in Crimea and the occupied areas of the Donbass, if they still remain occupied, are not going to look better.
Well, one of the things that arose last week was the idea of making Ukraine completely neutral and not bringing it into NATO would be an important move to allay some of the fears of Russia. The other thing that came up was this concern that the sanctions really are just harming everyday Russians rather than showing Putin anything, although I do understand the currency was really having some trouble last week. Martha Merritt, how do you see this?
I think that Russia is at her strongest and most united when Russia's in trouble. And so I think our notion that these smart sanctions, these relatively smart sanctions, which are more targeted than sanctions which affect the broad public, I think our notion that this will bring Putin's circle to its knees and they'll oppose him and, you know, maybe bring in someone new so that they can shake these financial burdens, that to my mind is not realistic. You know, the West trying to pressure Russia in this way, I think makes them, of course, there's a lot going on behind the scenes we're not hearing or seeing, but I think at this point, to sort of point an accusing finger at Putin would look like treason because, you know, the country is very actively involved on this high international level. So it's not so much the sanctions that are hurting the Russian economy broadly, though they're having an impact. It's the fact that world oil prices are at a virtual all-time low. Russia is still chiefly an oil export economy and therefore much more vulnerable to this sort of thing. The Russian currency is doing very badly, and this, of course, is more directly a sanctions-related thing. But there's kind of a rallying effect even now, you know, Henry mentioned rally around the flag, that is happening. And so I think to expect that this kind of pressure in the short term can bring change is perhaps not realistic. The Obama administration and leaders in Europe need to be making major behind-the-scenes efforts. Getting the sort of dialogue to be real dialogue instead of posturing needs to be happening now so that when and if there is a break where face can be saved on all parts and a resolution can come forward that will allow at least Ukraine, minus the Crimea, to sort of stand down, this would be a very important step forward for world security.
Thank you so much, Henry Hale, Martha Merritt. It's been such a great pleasure to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Hale is a professor of political science and international affairs and co-director of the program on new approaches to research and security in Eurasia at George Washington University. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? And the Foundations of Ethnic Politics, Separatism of States and Nations in Eurasia and the World. Henry Hale's latest book is Patronal Politics, Eurasian Regime Dynamics and Comparative Perspective. Martha Merritt is the Associate Dean for International Education at the University of Chicago. She's the author of A Geopolitics of Identity, Drawing the Line Between Russia and Estonia. And she's contributing author of Russian and Soviet History, From the Time of Troubles to the Collapse of the Soviet Union. And that is it for this week's edition of the Scholar Circle. Many thanks to everybody who makes this show possible, Ankin Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Kwatemok Aleman, and our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. Please be sure to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter at Armudian. If you missed a part of the show, you can always get them from the KPFK archives or from our own archives, scholarcircle.org. We'll see you next week.